Good evening. Tonight we have a delight in having Ann Harris to read for us. She's the author of the novels The Nature of Smoke and Accidental Creatures. Her latest is the forthcoming Inventing Memory, is a feminist romance that tackles the question, can women and men find happiness and liberation together, and goes all the way to ancient Sumeria and back to find the answer. Harris has been a long-term advocate of women's rights, reproductive freedom, and GLBT rights. Accidental Creatures won the first ever Spectrum Award for Best Novel Dealing with GLBT Characters, Themes, and Issues. The Nature of Smoke achieved distinction with a starred review in Publishers Weekly and a listing in Locust Magazine Magazine's recommended reading list. Harris has lived in the Metro Detroit area all her life, and her first two books are set in near-future Detroit industrial dystopias. Common themes in her work are chaos theory, biotechnology, personal freedom, and transformation. Harris has at various times worked as an operations research analyst for the Department of Defense, a vegetarian cook, a dry cleaner, a bookstore clerk, a small town reporter, and a PR writer. She has a degree in computer and information science from Oakland University. Ann Harris lives in Royal Oak with her husband Steve, their dog Rodney, cats Hector and Mavis. Welcome, Ann and Steve.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much for coming. I've selected a little bit out of each of my books to read, and I'm going to start with the newest one, which is forthcoming next winter. It's entitled Inventing Memory, and the book starts, I'm going to start with a quote from Monique Wittig from her book The Guerrières, which is on the front piece of the book, and then I'm going to jump to a scene a little bit further in about, we're on page 39. So, there was a time when you were not a slave. Remember that. You walked alone, full of laughter. You bathed bare-bellied. You say you have lost all recollection of it. Remember. The wild roses flower in the woods. Your hand is torn on the bushes gathering the mulberries and strawberries you refresh yourself with. You run to catch the young hares that you flay with stones from the rocks to cut them up and eat all hot and bleeding. You know how to avoid meeting a bear on the track. You know the winter fear when you hear the wolves gathering, but you can remain seated for hours in the treetops to await morning. You say there are no words to describe this time. You say it does not exist, but remember, make an effort to remember, or failing that, invent. The full moon peeked through a stand of date palms in a courtyard up ahead. Shula had no other company, so she walked toward it. The night was very blue in the silver light. As she stepped around a corner, the moon's glow struck her full in the face. Heavy and full, like a bowl ready to spill its water, like a woman aching for birth, it hung above the garden gate. A pair of dogs howled somewhere behind her, and she realized that she was already through the gate. In the middle of the garden stood a large tree which held the moon in its branches. Beneath it sat the girl with the wings, the snake, and the Anzu bird, sharing a flagon of wine. Welcome, said the girl. Sit with us. Share our wine. Shula eyed the Anzu bird nervously, but its wings were folded, its beak dipped demurely into its bowl of wine. I didn't realize it was this garden, said Shula. You came in from a different gate than the one you let me pass through, said the girl. Please, join us. It is because of you that we celebrate in our new home. Shula hesitated, thinking of the incident at the river. But I serve the goddess Inanna. I'd think twice about serving anyone if I were you, said the snake. You've been walking a long time. Aren't your feet tired? Shula realized they were, and the dark girl was smiling at her with teeth shining like the moon. The girl stood and held out her hand. Since you first admitted me here, it is only fitting that you should now be my guest. Shula remembered her dumb nod to the question, can I come in? She could not argue with the girl's logic. Moreover, She could not refuse that steady gaze which took all of her in and saw not just a slave of Ur-Nyattu, but her, Shula. She stepped forward to take the girl's outstretched hand, and they sat down on the grass together. "Who are you?" asked Shula. "I am Belili," she said, pouring Shula a bowl of wine. Shula took the bowl from her hands and drank. The wine was sweet and strong. She glanced surreptitiously at Belili's wings. "You aren't a girl. I mean a mortal girl," she said. Belili laughed. "Indeed not. I may seem young, but I am very, very old." "Older than Erech?" "Older than Erech." "Older than Sumeria?" "Older than Enki." "Enki?" Shula raised her eyebrows in surprise. "But he created the heavens and the earth." The Anzu bird fluttered its wings and squawked. "That's what he says," said Belili, her eyes shining in the moonlight. "Marduk will tell you another story. Ask me, and I will tell you a third." Shula bit her lip. "But which story is true?" Belili looked at her, the expression on her shadowed face unreadable. "Why, mine is, of course." The snake said, "One story is older than another. Another one older than that. Which story is true, the oldest one or the one people believe?" "Tell me your story," said Shula, leaning forward and placing her hand on Belili's knee. "Well, all right, but just the short version. There was a tree, and a snake lived in the tree. A woman ate from the tree and learned the magic of names. She named everything she saw, and those names are what the world is made of," said Belili as she poured more wine into Shula's bowl. The snake slid across the ground and lifted its head to rest on Shula's knee. "So, what do you think of the predetermination of evil in the doctrine of free will?" it asked her. "What?" said Shula, almost spilling her wine. "You know, if mortals have free will, evil must exist so they can choose it. If there were no evil, everything would just be good, and no one would notice. No one would be good, actually. They'd just have no other choice. You see, with evil, you have a choice." Shula wrinkled her brow. "I guess so, but why can't there be other choices besides just good and evil?" The snake hissed with approval. "Yes, it is for questions such as these that we like you." "Truly," said Belili, leaning forward to brush the hair away from Shula's face. "With a mind like that, you should be a priestess." The Anzu bird shifted its weight from one foot to another and back again, croaking appreciatively. "A priestess? But I'm only a slave." Belili raised one shoulder in indifference. "If that narrow-nosed bureaucrat, Shapar, can sing the songs and bring Inanna down, why not you? After all, she chose you." Shula shook her head. "I thought you didn't want me to serve anybody." Belili smiled slowly. "I didn't say serve." "Oh." Shula felt frightened. What were they asking of her? "But aren't Inanna's priestesses supposed to serve her? Wouldn't the goddess punish me if I didn't do her will? And what would I do instead?" Belili shook her head. "So many questions. Drink now. The moon awaits." Shula did, her eyelids fluttering up to reveal a great white face, leaning so close now between the branches that she could feel her icy breath. "That's close," she said, gasping from her long drink. "Very close. Come here." The moonlight was radiant on Belili's stomach and thighs. Shula turned and let that lap hold her, let those arms and legs encircle her. She rested her head on Belili's shoulder and looked up at the moon. "Do you remember your mother?" asked Belili. She shook her head. "No, I am a Semite, a captive of war. But I don't remember the war or how I lived before it. Now I have no mother or father. I am a slave in the house of Ur-Nyattu and do not even have a little god to watch over me." Shula tipped her head back to peer at Belili. Will you be my guardian? She asked. Yes, certainly, if you will remember that you were not always a slave. But how can I? My life before I came to Iraq is a murky pond, and I have no net or line to draw up what might be in there. Then if you cannot remember, invent. Make up your own story. So that's a bit from Inventing Memory, and I probably should have mentioned ahead of time that this is in the section that takes place in ancient Sumeria. So now you know. And then I'm going to go move on now to to Accidental Creatures. And this is my second novel. And this is a book that takes place in Detroit. And it's a future corporate intrigue, labor union organizing, creatures run amok novel. And we're gonna start with Helix. And she's just run away from home. She was adopted, she believes at least that she was adopted, by a scientist at a company called Genesis, and his name is Hector Martin. So. As she approached the man with the cigarette, he called out to her, "Where are you going, honey?" She didn't answer. She kept on going. But they were closing in behind her, too. Finally, after seconds stretched out by the rasp of her breath, her footsteps stuttered to a halt, and she could turn to see the two who now stood side by side in the middle of the alley, blocking her exit. They were lean young men with old faces and dirty t-shirts. One of them was the guy with red hair she'd nearly collided with earlier. The other one held the glimmering threat of a knife at his side. From behind her, a hand fell on her shoulder. "Hey, lady, you got some spare change?" "No," she said, and turned halfway to face him. She stepped back, trying to keep all three of them in view. "No?" the one with the knife queried. "You better be lying." She shook her head and took another step back, but Red Hair grabbed her arm, twisted it behind her, and she gasped at the sudden flash of pain. She paused. "I don't know. Let me see." "Yeah," laughed the one who'd been smoking. "That's more like it. Why don't we see what you've got? I'm sure we can use it, whatever it is." "My wallet's in the inside pocket," she lied. "Let me open my coat." "Aw, don't strain yourself, darling. I'll do it for you," said Cigarette, and he proceeded to slowly unbutton her coat. Her breath sounded harsh and loud as he worked his fingers over the buttons, undoing them one by one. He was standing close. So much the better, she thought, as she waited for him to finish with the third button at waist level. He undid it, and looking up at her, smiled. "I think that's enough, for now, anyway." She smiled back at him, widely, baring her fangs, and shot her lower right fist through the opening of the coat and into his midsection, while she stomped on the instep of the assailant behind her with her left foot. Cigarette doubled over from the force of her blow. "What the fuck?" Meanwhile, the grip on her upper right arm had loosened momentarily. It was enough for her to wrench it free, and shrugging her shoulders, she let the coat fall to her feet. She stretched out her forearms so there could be no mistake, and turned so she was facing all three of her attackers, revealed for what she was. Their faces registered shock, but Knife only hesitated for a moment before he was upon her, driving his blade towards her belly. She grabbed his hands in hers and pulled him towards her, forcing his arms up as she kneed him in the groin. He sagged in her arms and she released him, pushing him from her as he fell to the ground, curled into a tight ball of pain. Red Hair ducked to one side, dived, and rolled, and with a quick jerk, yanked at the coat still lying around her feet. The next thing she knew, she was on the ground, and Cigarette, recovered, rushed up and delivered a vicious kick to her head. Her vision blurred momentarily, and her head sang with pain. She rolled away as he was winding up for another kick, but Red Hair was there. I don't know what you are, but you just made a big mistake. And he kicked her too, in the stomach. More kicks came, sharp punctuations of pain in her ribs, her abdomen, and her head. She rolled onto her back and grabbed somebody's foot with all four of her hands, twisting his ankle and knocking him off balance. In that brief and partial respite, she forced herself to her feet. Red Hair closed in again, grabbing for her arms. She let him have the lower two, and with the others grabbed his head, bent it back, and with her jaws stretched wide, she sank her teeth into the side of his neck. He screamed, and something sharp sank into her side. She released Red Hair and turned, snarling, her mouth smeared with blood, the face knife. His eyes widened with fear, and she used his moment of hesitation to smash a fist into his face. Fuck, someone was screaming. She wasn't sure who. Let's go. She heard footsteps running away, caught a glimpse of their backs as the three of them fled, one limping, one bleeding. She was bleeding too. In fact, she didn't feel well at all, she thought, as she sank to the ground. She didn't pass out, but only lay there, her face against the dirty concrete, staring at a trodden gum wrapper. She should get out of there, she thought, but when she tried to move, everything, and especially that bleeding spot low on the left side of her back, hurt. She put her hand to it. It didn't seem very big to be producing so much blood. She tried to keep a hand over it, pressing, to stop the flow, but she kept forgetting. All of this reminded her of something, some other time when she'd lain beaten on the ground. When had that been? What had she done then? When? On that regrettable day at the orphanage? But Hector had rescued her from that place, and now she'd left him. Footsteps, just one set, approached slowly. She tried to turn and look, but pain lanced up her spine and she subsided, closing her eyes. Whoever it was would come, search for a wallet or something valuable, and hopefully leave her alone. The footsteps stopped, and she felt a hand on her upper right arm. Are you okay? No. I'll call an ambulance. No, she shouted, which made her head hurt. No doctors, please. I'm all right. I'll be fine. I just need to rest a little, okay? Please, just leave me alone. But you've been stabbed, possibly in the kidney. You need help. No, I don't need any help. I'm fine. With the remainder of her strength, Helix forced herself up onto her hands and knees, and then, using the wall, dragged herself to a standing position. Pain arced through her body, and she trembled. See, she said to the stranger, who she still had not looked at. I'm fine. I'm leaving now. See? I'm fine. And she took a step, and the pain made her gasp. But she kept her footing for a moment, until dizziness swooped in from the corners of her vision like the black, confused wings of birds. And she fell into the arms of this stranger, who, as it turned out, was not very big at all. Staggering under her weight, the stranger slowly returned her to the ground. Okay, she said. Helix still hadn't gotten a very good look at her face, just a quick blur of small pointed features and something peculiar about the eyes. Okay, no doctors. I've got a car. I parked it under the overpass on Monroe. I'll go get it, and I'll take you to see someone. Not a doctor, a friend of mine. Hang on. And she took one of Helix's hands and placed it over the wound in her side. Keep that there. You don't want to lose any more blood. I'll be right back. And she was, with a rag which she tied around Helix's waist. I shouldn't be moving you at all, but I can't get that boat of a car down this alley. Here, give me your arms. She wrapped Helix's right arms around her shoulder, and with her arm around Helix's waist, gently lifted her up to a standing position and steadied her. Wait, my raincoat, said Helix. Forget it, you can get another one. No, I need it. Then I'll come back for it. Now let's go. And together they spent the most excruciating 10 minutes of Helix's life, getting her out of the alley and into the back seat of the stranger's car. A motor car, a big old convertible with the top down, ancient but still functioning. Helix stared up at the sky, the night air chilled through the fabric of her bodysuit. My raincoat. The stranger sighed. Okay, hang on. She was back again in a moment, and she put the now torn and soiled raincoat over Helix, tucking it in on the sides. Just as well. You need to keep warm. The car rumbled to noisy life and started to move. Helix didn't ask where they were going. She just gazed up at the night sky, at the stars spinning far above her. Water break.
The choice of what you want is always dry.
Yeah. Well, they have to keep it that way because of the books. Isn't that right? I should talk to you because I'm working on a young adult novel about an enormous library.
Yeah,
me too. Mm-hmm. Cool. Yeah, I'll email you some stuff.
Okay.
Now, this last is just a brief bit from my first novel, The Nature of Smoke. And it introduces one of my favorite characters. I don't know, I just thought I wanted to read something from each one of them, so. Ms. Wujcik led Magnolia down several long, darkly paneled hallways before she stopped at a pair of doors with big brass handles. This is the greenhouse. Mr. Tunkari spends a great deal of time here. She pulled open the doors, and Magnolia followed her into another world. They were surrounded by plants, trees dripping with vines, brilliant pink and orange flowers like neon starbursts, mosses and grasses shining with dew. Magnolia struggled for breath in the sudden heat and damp. Above them, birds fluttered from branch to branch, their singing filling the air with chaos. Out of the corner of her eye, Magnolia caught sight of movement. Something four-legged and sleek darted through the ground cover. "I think you've got rats," she said to Ms. Wujcik, but she only smiled and led Magnolia on towards the sound of running water. They came to a large pond dotted with round, flat, green leaves. A man floated amongst them, his arms sweeping lazily through the water. He caught sight of Magnolia and Ms. Wujcik standing on the gravel path beside the pond, and he drifted closer. "Mr. Tunkari, this is Magnolia," said Ms. Wujcik, as if she were used to giving introductions from land to water. She probably was. Tunkari had broad shoulders, blonde hair, a magazine handsome face, and brilliant green eyes. He smiled and folded his arms behind his head. "I'm pleased to have you with us, Magnolia." He nodded faintly. "You show great promise. You'll be working with Kalira. He's training Spider and Dex, too. Have you met them?" "Yes." Tunkari laughed. "Yes. Well, I always thought we learn at least as much from our peers as we do from our teachers." He turned and dived beneath the surface of the water. Magnolia fidgeted uneasily and glanced at Ms. Wujcik. Her round, placid face revealed nothing. A moment later, Tunkari resurfaced with one of the water plants in his hand. Magnolia had seen something like it at a garden in New York. "Is that a water lily?" she asked. Tunkari smiled. "You're very intelligent, aren't you?" "No, it's not a plant at all, actually. It is, or rather was, an animal. A genetically engineered one. Here, take it." Magnolia knelt beside the pool and took the thing from Tunkari's hands. It was losing its green color, fading into transparency. A fine network of veins became visible. Tunkari gestured across the pool. "They eat bacteria, algae, that kind of thing. They keep the pond clean. They're very good at it. It's what they were designed to do. Turn it over." The underside of the leaf was covered with fine, feather-like membranes. Tunkari continued. "That's where the bacteria is metabolized. It's really a very intricate process. A thick stem trailed away from the center of the leaf. Magnolia picked up the shattered end. Some sort of fluid oozed gently out of it, staining the gravel at her feet. Of course, once you break them off from the main stem, they die instantly. Another leaf will grow to replace that one within a few days. But you were right. They do look like water lilies, don't they, Magnolia? Tunkari's eyes shone the color of the air in that green, fecund place, and Magnolia, staring at him, became hypnotized. You know, he said, sometimes, at night when it's very quiet and the house is absolutely still, I can feel their thoughts moving through the water. Thank you very much.
So how do you do your research for things like ancient Sumeria?
Oh, I did a lot of reading. I did a lot of reading. I found some really good books. There's a book called Early Mesopotamia, and unfortunately the author's name escapes me at the moment, but that was very helpful. I read a lot of Kramer as a noted scholar of ancient Sumeria, and particularly the literature of ancient Sumeria, which I delve into quite a bit. I read a lot of him, and unfortunately I wasn't able to go there because, well, it's Iraq. And unfortunately, a lot of the archaeological sites have been or probably will be bombed out of existence. Do you have a question?
Other questions?
Oh, well.
I just found that utterly fascinating to read.
Well, oh, thank you. Well, I have a brother who is a PhD in microbiology, and he has been a tremendous resource. I also, this isn't as much with the biology, but I went to a polymer plant. The Polymer Research. There's a Polymer Research Institute associated with Detroit Mercy College. And I went there. And that was helpful. That was, the vat rooms are based off of what I saw there. I do a lot of reading. I read, Scientific American puts out a wonderful series of books about all kinds of different topics. But all of those are really good. And some textbooks my brother lent me, and a lot of stuff I kind of, frankly, I reverse engineer, and I do what I want to do, and then I show it to my brother, and I say, okay, how can we make this work? You know, how can this be made to seem
plausible?
Exactly. Yeah. So I'm really happy to hear that it worked for you. You know, yeah.
My background is biology.
Oh, great. That's good to know. Yeah, I really like, I have a computer science background, but I have not done nearly as much science fictionally with that as I've done with the biological sciences, because it turns out that I just really like things to like come alive and then run amok.
Nature of Smoke?
Oh, I read a lot about chaos theory for The Nature of Smoke. The book itself is about chaos theory in general, and even has sort of a chaotic structure. It's got kind of a strange attractor structure to the story itself. And I've been fascinated by chaos theory ever since I heard about it. I first read James Glick's book Chaos, which is a wonderful, wonderful book about that, and then just a whole bunch of other stuff. I read as much of Benoit Mandelbrot as I could get through.
Which was all.
That was really intense. Yeah, really intense. So I pretty much just read everything I get my hands on that. A lot of the technology, I'm probably going to have to, my editor's probably going to say, call them up and make them take this out. A lot of the technology, a lot of the little things, a lot of the incidental technology in the nature of smoke is stuff I come up with off the top of my head. You know, because it sounded good. You know, pneumatic wristwatches, for God's sakes. I mean, they've got these little balloons that inflate and deflate and power the watch mechanism. Well, I don't know. I just thought it sounded kind of cool.
Science?
Well, yeah, sure, absolutely. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
So there you go. Yeah.
So you have plans for working on background work for another novel?
Yeah, I do. In fact, I'm working on a sequel to The Nature of Smoke, in fact. I thought that the what happens at the end of The Nature of Smoke raised some questions in my mind about exactly what this virus that Sid has created really does do. And partly I wanted to look at that. And partly I wanted to get back to some of those characters and do more with them, more with some of the characters who are more minor or support characters in this book. I wanted to do more with them. And then I just got a killer coming-of-age gay romance storyline, you know, that just came upon me. So it's going to be about Antonin, who is a little boy in this book. And he'll be a teenager in this new book. And a lot of it is from his point of view and what he's going through growing up and having a very overprotective mother in Rose. And his infatuation with his roommate and so on and so forth.
I found myself wanting to learn more about some of the characters in Accidental Creatures.
Did you?
Yeah, particularly the, I can't remember his name, the one who goes home to his Jewish family.
Oh, Hector.
Yeah, it was Hector.
Yes, Hector Martin.
I'd like to have known more about his background.
Okay.
I found that quite interesting.
Yeah.
And then the other character who was in Big Time to the religious group, that storyline would have been...
Oh, Colin Slattermeyer.
That would have been interesting to follow a little more of that.
You know, Colin Slattermeyer wound up taking the bullet for Hector Martin. Because, and I mean, yes, in the story, but also quite, I mean, in a literary, okay, I'm not even going to try that. originally, in the first draft of Accidental Creatures, Hector Martin's killed. And my editor said, you can't kill Hector Martin. So I thought about it. So, sure, I can't kill him. And he's like, yeah, no, really, you can't. And I said, okay. So somebody had to die. So it wound up being poor Colin, who is a lot of fun. I really like him. I'm glad you brought that up. I'd forgotten kind of about him. But his whole business, where he gets kidnapped by the Lilim, and he's just at wits, and he's just going nuts the whole time, and I felt sorry for him too, because what a position to be in, you know, under Nathan Graham's thumb, and you know, indentured basically to this religious cult and stuff. Yeah, unfortunately, we probably won't find anything more about him since he's dead. But you never know; something could be written about Hector again someday. Hey!
Hey!
Hi!
Hi.
How you doing?
Okay.
Good.
You can always write one of those prequels that people are writing now.
Yeah.
The old characters.
Yeah. I'm glad you mentioned him. Hector is one of my favorite characters in that book, too. I really, you know, I wanted to write about a Victor Frankenstein with a moral conscience.
Yeah, he almost behaved like a lost puppy.
Yeah.
Just totally befuddled with the world.
We did. We named our cat Hector.
Are there other questions? Any other comments you'd like to make?
I don't know.
Any advice for young writers?
Sure. Keep writing. Don't, like, you know, don't let anybody tear you down. And I don't know. Don't get discouraged, because it's not easy.
One of our writers that was in spring semester last year said he had plastered his entire room with his rejection letters.
Yeah.
He says you just have to get over it.
Yeah, yeah, you really do. You really do. And it's just, and it's not easy. I'm not as good at that as I get really pissed off. But the good thing about that is that it motivates me. You know, so really, whatever reaction you have, that's the reaction you have. As long as you find a way to continue and to be motivated to send it someplace else. One thing I do is when I send it someplace, I begin to prepare for the next market I'm going to send it to. I go so far as to write a cover letter and address an envelope to that next place so that when it does come back, I'm all ready to send it out again, because I find I feel better as soon as it's out the door again. Then somehow there's new hope, and that past rejection is in the past, you know, and I can go on with my life such as it is.
Any other questions or comments? Thank you very much, Anna.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you very much. I really had a nice time.
Thank you.